Maybe we can begin by talking about how you came to question the theory that HIV causes AIDS.
Well, in Women's Health Interaction, we have, you know, for all the years that we've been together and being active on different issues, women's health issues, we have questioned the medical model, this sort of high-tech, drug-related biomedical model where there is, for every illness, there is a pill and where things are only seen in that kind of light and you know, where it is not looked at other, like, more social causes and other causes. And so when the issue of AIDS started to come around, what we noticed was there was sort of, like, for people that we were allies with that were always questioning this model, they were not questioning it around that issue. And so we started from curiosity and sort of wondering, like, how come? You know, it seemed, even not knowing much of, you know, not knowing, in fact, that there were actual so-called dissidents, actual people who questioned the theory, we felt it was kind of strange that people that had always, you know, had a lot of questions around health issues and how the system worked, dealt with them, were not doing that in this case. And so we started to read a lot, and some, you know, some of it come also directly out of our the work that we were most involved with, which is around reproductive rights. And we were working a lot with groups in third world countries who were criticizing their country's so-called population control programs, where women are often, you know, strongly encouraged and sometimes actually coerced into taking contraceptives. And some of the literature on population control, which we've been extremely critical about because it's very much, you know, a detriment of women's health and women's rights, some of the literature started to combine the AIDS issues with the population control. So there was one newspaper article at some point about a vaccine that was in the making that would prevent the spread of HIV, and at the same time it would act as a female contraceptive. And then we saw articles about how distributing condoms in Africa against AIDS would at the same time curb the population growth. So we saw those two things named in one breath, you know, and we felt like, ooh, these are the people that we have been very critical of all along. Like, how come, you know, we're seeing these things together? So then we started to read, and both standard, you know, conventional, if you can call it, AIDS literature, as well as the dissidents, the people who started to question, actually, and have been questioning for a long time, the whole theory around AIDS, and we saw a lot of things in common with with how we have been questioning things elsewhere. And then, you know, then the next thing that started to come into the media was how women who had children who were HIV positive were being either forced to stop breastfeeding, or if they were pregnant and they were discovered that they were HIV positive, they were forced into taking drugs. Women were starting to lose control over their own choices and their own bodies. And so that's when we really decided we wanted to do something with this issue.
Can you just briefly run down some of the main features of the so-called dissident position?
The virus, HIV itself, has never been separated. So they have not been able to demonstrate what the virus looks like. They haven't been able to put it under a microscope. They haven't been able to multiply it in a culture, say in a laboratory. It's basically a hypothesis that HIV exists in the first place. And then if you look at how it behaves itself in people who are HIV positive, it's also questionable whether it can be such a deadly virus. Because there's many people that are HIV positive for 15 and 20 years. We now have, you know, so-called HIV survivors that have been HIV positive for 20 years, and they have not had any illness other than a cold here and there that you and I might have as well. And so if that virus is so extremely virulent and deadly, then why are those people not dead? Now, the conventional side of things have been trying to find ways to explain this, but what from the dissident perspective people are saying, well, you know, possibly HIV exists, but it may be entirely harmless, and possibly people who get sick with the syndrome, because AIDS is not an actual disease like tuberculosis is, but it's a whole syndrome. You have to have like a number of different symptoms to be diagnosed with AIDS. That AIDS, once that developed, is actually part of a whole number of different things, different factors, which may be immunological, which may be poverty and malnutrition, which may be drug use, recreational drug use, and which may also be, unfortunately, the toxic chemotherapy with the so-called anti-HIV drugs, you know, such as AZT and protease inhibitors. And so from the dissident perspective, there's a lot of things to question. There's a lot of things that have not been demonstrated clearly enough to say, okay, HIV causes AIDS, therefore we need to use toxic drugs to kill the HIV and save the patient.
Let's talk a little bit about statistics and how those are used and how those are presented in the mainstream media in particular, but also in the progressive media to describe the what's called the AIDS epidemic. There was a drop in infection rates, according to all the authorities. Can you talk about what they're measuring, and with specific reference to women, and how the infection rate of women is presented and understood in the media?
Yes. See, over the time of when first AIDS started to be discovered and named in the mid-80s until now, there's been like a whole change in the profile of who has AIDS and who doesn't, or there has been some change in the profile. And if we look at North America, AIDS in North America, because, you know, in the beginning, it very clearly was a number of groups, homosexuals, drug users, so there was a, you know, and then hemophiliacs, people who use blood products. So there was a couple of, you know, very clear groups that that were affected by this. And then over the course of the years, they started to see that there was also a number of women, for instance, that would be affected. So this, given that this pattern kind of changed, that means that, you know, proportionately, if you look at like how many women out of the whole of the group of people with AIDS, there have been over the past 5-7 years, maybe, there have been an increase in the proportion. Like there is somewhat more women compared to the number of men. But the overall, as you say, very rightfully so, the overall numbers of AIDS cases have decreased, and that's been going on for at least 8 years. That yearly, the number of people who are affected, who are new cases, say new diagnoses of AIDS, have gone down. Their number has gone down. So in 1995, for instance, there were almost 1,400 new AIDS cases. This is in Canada. And in 1996, there was only 712, which is like almost 50% reduction in new AIDS cases. The number of women in 95 was just over 100, and in 96 it was just over 60. And so that also is a drop in almost 50%. But now if you look at how this was presented in the media, what they said, well, you know, in 1995 there was 8% of the cases of new AIDS cases were women, and in 1996 it was 9.4%. So what we have here is an increase of 1.4% among women. And so that then made it in the media. Big headings, women, big headings actually even saying women are the largest group of new AIDS victims. You know, there was like a whole new wording around it, like that really women were now, you know, all women were now at risk of getting AIDS. And that's definitely, you know, completely counter to the statistics, where women, in fact, had a lot less, there was a lot less new AIDS cases 1 year to the next, and still it has continued to decrease every year. And so this is a little bit in terms of how statistics are manipulated. If you look at it, the fact that we're still calling this an epidemic, if you look at the statistics, it's not at all true. You know, the numbers are on the decline. The picture, if you look at since the mid-80s until now, if you look at how many cases there have been, you make a graph out of that, it doesn't look like an epidemic, like a microbe epidemic, an infectious epidemic would have happened. So really the word is used outside of proportions. And so now this was a North American example. Now people are saying, well, yeah, but AIDS is really, it's in the third world where we need to be scared, because that's where everybody pretty soon is going to have it. And there again, it is there is a whole manipulation of data that happens. The statistics that are being given by the World Health Organization, for instance, or by other UN, United Nations organizations, there's a UN AIDS organization, those statistics are all based on a small research that is done, and that's then predicted for the whole continent. For instance, in Africa, they've done some testing of women at clinics where women would come who were pregnant. They then extrapolated from the number of HIV-positive women in these clinics to the whole continent. Well, unfortunately for them, one thing that we know is that the test for HIV can give a lot of false positives. Like somebody can test positive but does not, you know, there really is no virus there. And one of these cross reactions, one of the reactions with the test that causes a false positive test is pregnancy. And so you're going to test pregnant women, a number of them will be false positive. And if you then extrapolate to the whole continent, well, you've got a really skewed figure. And so this is, you know, this is one of the things that has been happening. And so pregnancy is one of them. There's a number of other diseases that test false positive on this test, which include tuberculosis and malaria. And, you know, everybody knows that tuberculosis and malaria are still very widespread in third world countries. And so if we're, you know, even if we would test everybody, we would still have a lot of people testing positive, where it's not AIDS that we need to be afraid of, but it's tuberculosis or malaria that needs to be treated. And so that's, you know, that's really how the statistics have been presented falsely. And it really has real negative consequences. Again, if we look at the third world, what it has done is that a lot of the money that's available for work in health has been going to AIDS-type work, whether it's AIDS prevention, clinics, or trying to get drugs for people. But, you know, it has gone into that area very specifically and moved away from primary health care, which we know that was already not very good and has deteriorated since this whole era of panic, I might say, about AIDS.
There's been a huge push in South Africa to expand prenatal testing for women, well, for pregnant women, and to provide drug treatment for pregnant women. Is there anything that you want to say about that on the basis of your research?
Well, the South African situation is kind of interesting because Mbeki also was the first official figure, I think, or, you know, important state figure who questioned the validity of the HIV causes AIDS theory. And the jury is still out in South Africa in terms of how much the whole system there, the whole country, and the healthcare in the country will put into, you know, the importance of testing for HIV or not. But at the same time, there has been also a push from many third world countries to get drugs available at much cheaper rates. And that, you know, we can only stand behind that in as a general concept. Like, why would the pharmaceutical industry need to earn so much money because they have the hold a patent over a drug, where countries like third world countries that have very small health budgets can't afford? And, you know, and this becomes especially important, I think, you know, when we're looking at how widespread tuberculosis is and malaria is, and so how drugs for those diseases probably could make a contribution, you know. It becomes more complicated from our perspective when we talk about the AIDS drugs, because here we are talking about very toxic drugs that would potentially be given to pregnant women, which is a very vulnerable state, both for the woman as for a developing fetus in the woman who's very vulnerable to any kind of outside intervention, whether it's drugs or whether it is even, you know, the woman getting sick. We know all, you know, she were to get rubella. We know that can have an effect on the fetus. So there is, it's a very, like, a very fragile state. Want to see it like that. And a lot of drugs, in fact, they're, you know, there's always said, like, don't take this when you're pregnant, or they won't even test them to see whether they could be taken during pregnancy at all or not. And so, you know, that raises a whole other concern there about the use of the drugs during pregnancy.
So a lot of your work is centered around rights for women and their children, and the restrictions that the medical profession has tried to put on women who are testing positive for HIV. Can you discuss any of the cases that you've been involved with?
Yeah, we've been we've been more active involved with one particular case that was situated in Canada. We are very aware of quite a number of them in the U.S. as well, and some of the people that the organization that were involved with that have supported us in the case here in Canada. This really is a, you know, of grave concern, I think. The one case here in Canada concerned a woman who had been HIV positive for 15 years without ever having any health problems, and had two healthy children who were discovered HIV positive and were forced to take the AIDS drugs. And because she refused it, she was taken to court by the Child Protection Services here in Montreal. In fact, this is where the case took place, and her children were removed from her custody. And very tragically, within weeks of starting to take the treatment, the kids got very, very sick, and so she took matters in her own hands and left the country with the children. The use of these drugs, you know, there is possibly something to say to see if there is benefits once somebody actual is starting to get symptoms of immune depletion, but to give drugs that are that toxic to somebody who is basically healthy, you're asking for trouble. You know, parts of our body that are protecting us, like our liver and our immune system, our kidneys, they're being affected by these drugs directly. So, you know, how can we remain healthy under that kind of a treatment? So that's a really, that's a big concern when then you're going to give these drugs to kids. In the States, there's been one woman who successfully went to court and got permission for her youngest child not to take the drugs, but she already tragically had lost her first child, and which for her was due to the drug use. And so, you know, the issue there is one of concern over health. The other one is of who has the right to choose. You know, if we're talking about pregnant women, if they're HIV positive, does she have the right to choose? This is her own body, whether she, you know, wants the treatment or not. And to take that a step further, is she going to get all the information to make an informed consent over whether she wants the treatment or not? And this is another part where there is, you know, where we felt like we really needed to publish this booklet that we did, which is, you know, it's called Uncommon Questions because it is full of questions about the paradigm and about how it is, how AIDS is being treated and how women are being treated who test HIV positive. And, you know, the raising of these questions, I think, is what is part of, you know, the full package of information that people need to get before they can even make any decision over treatment or not treatment, over testing or not testing. So that's another part of what we're advocating.
It seems to me that there's at least a couple distinct issues. One is about HIV and the test and what it means and what the statistics mean. And then there's also the question of what are conditions that are associated with immune deficiency, and what are ways to treat immune deficiency? Because obviously people are ill and are sickening and dying with immune deficiency all over the world. We don't have much time, but as a naturopath, what are some of the recommendations that you make to people who are experiencing those health problems?
Well, you know, first of all, when you say people are dying from immune deficiency all over the world, can't emphasize enough that that is mostly social, political, and that most of these people that are dying all over the world are malnourished and do not have the proteins and the vitamins and other essential nutrients that they need. Okay, that is really, really a basic issue. And that issue might also largely apply to, if you look at, you know, who gets sick with AIDS in Canada or in the U.S. If I see somebody who is showing first symptoms of the severe immune depletion that might result into AIDS, I'm going to have a very different approach from when I have somebody who is, you know, who also has immune deficiency that I see because they get the cold every 3-4 weeks they're sick, and then they get pneumonia, and then, you know, that's a very different expression of the immune system being weakened. You know, like very much the central focus of a treatment plan would be the diet, would be changing a lifestyle to make sure that you have rest, that you have relaxation, that you do exercise, like some real basic things, right? And then on top of that, I might have a number of remedies that I would prescribe.
But it looks to me that the HIV theory is a very convenient one for authorities who want to explain away sickness and illness locally, nationally, internationally.
Absolutely. No, you hit the nail on the head there, I think, because if we can, something that's as threatening as AIDS, where, you know, the first cases of AIDS, clearly people were, they came into a doctor's office and they were dead in a very short period of time. So a very threatening thing, if we could say, first of all, it's not us, it's those other groups, because that was one first thing. And then, oh, hooray, we found the cause of that. And if we stay away from that, then it won't affect us either. Also, if we say it is a virus, like now we're talking again third world, for instance, if we say it's a virus, then we won't have to look at the implications of hunger and widespread infections like tuberculosis and malaria, which of course are all poverty diseases. And we won't have to do anything about that, about this global distribution of wealth that is just so unjust. Very clearly also, the other people that are really going to gain from this theory is the medical industry, the pharmaceutical industry, because if it is a virus, then we can attack it with a drug and we can make some money off it. So, you know, you're right, with that is the simple way. We won't have to look at any social issues and any other issues that might be very uncomfortable.
thank you very much, Carla, for joining us and sharing some of your knowledge with us. And I hope that we'll be able to talk again and go over some of the finer points of this debate and discussion.
Great, Kristen. Happy International Women's Day.
Okay, thank you.